normal service has been resumed. This is Media Talk. Coming up...
It's critical. The media is going to have to charge for content.
Financial Times editor Lionel Barber says the future will be paid for. What in Google's name is he talking about? Also in the podcast...
If I start spraying around the names of ordinary working reporters on the News of the World, that opens the door to the organisation saying, ah, more Clive Goodmans, more rogue reporters we didn't know about. And the organisation will blame the lowly individuals rather than accepting whatever responsibility is due to themselves.
Nick Davis produces more evidence against the News of the World as the Murdoch Gate phone hacking saga continues. Plus, the BBC's top brass are told to grow a pair by the new culture secretary. And is this the best bit of drama currently coming from the corporation? And...
I think the underlying problem with Twitter is for celebrities that go on it, it's a big I am. And for the older generation, it's a big I'm young. And as a young person, we don't want to hear about either of that.
Non-tweeting teenagers tell us about their new media habits. I'm Matt Wells, and this is Media Talk from The Guardian. Now, in the last fortnight, we've travelled to Nottingham. We have been live in front of a studio audience, and we had to hastily assemble a panel after it was revealed that the news of the screws had been up to no good. More on that story later, of course, in good Kirsty Walk style. But first, let me introduce this week's panel. Maggie Brown is a Media Guardian columnist, but with the savage axing of Arlene Phillips. Maggie, from the Strictly Come Dancing crew, perhaps a new career on the ballroom beckons.
Who knows? I'm willing.
You could be the new Arlene Phillips, I feel.
Except I can't dance.
Oh, no. Steve Ackerman is the managing director of Something Else, the independent production company behind everything from Five Lives 606 to Gardener's Question Time on Radio 4. And you also look after Jeremy Kyle, don't you?
We do.
Have you recovered from that meal at the radio festival?
still trying to.
There's plenty to get through this week, so we'll start with the press. The Financial Times editor Lionel Barber created a stir by predicting that, quote, almost all news organisations will be charging for online content within a year. In a speech called Why Journalism Matters, the FT boss said that finding successful pay schemes was probably the biggest challenge facing the newspaper industry. I spoke to him before he went on stage.
The business model based on advertising for print media is definitely under severe threat, and that's forcing news organisations to look elsewhere for revenues. We saw recently a misguided effort by the Washington Post to create new revenues by essentially offering access, favoured access to journalists with lobbyists paying the tag, picking up the tag. That's been discounted and thrown away.
What do you think
quite
of that?
Big mistake. Should have been nixed at a much earlier stage. And they've recognised that, in fairness. But the crucial point here is that the internet offers opportunities for news organisations. The Financial Times, for example, is diversified substantially. We're charging for content.
How's that going?
That's going very well.
How many of your subscribers resubscribe when their initial subscribing period runs out?
Lots. But the crucial point here is that the media is going to have to charge for content. It's critical because quality journalism requires large investment. If you've got a Financial Times as a news organisation which is global, we've got more than 100 foreign correspondents, you need to do quality journalism requires money, and therefore we need new revenues.
I also pick up on that. How are news organisations going to do that? You can do it because you have a particular specialism that nobody else, perhaps you could argue, can provide. But for general news organisations where news is available in so many different sources for free, how are they going to do that?
Yeah, specialists definitely have an advantage. And for the Financial Times, premium brand, premium content, we've doubled the charge of the price of the newspaper and increased substantially revenues as a result. That we're in a good spot as a specialist business publication with a global presence. It's tougher for general newspaper. Got to be distinctive, if I may say. The Guardian does have a certain distinctiveness as the kind of liberal-minded organ, and you manage to grow an audience in the States as well. Similarly, you could imagine some of the tabloids specialising in celebrity journalism, standing up for the common man, this kind of thing.
Well, people pay for that, too?
People, yes. If they feel that it's distinctive enough and it's different, you've got to be different, set yourself apart from the common. The way I look at it is, the internet, as many people believe, and I address this, is dumbing down journalism. Actually, I think it offers an opportunity for smartening up. And if you're distinctive, premium brand, then there's opportunities. It's the people in the middle, the mediocre middle, is what's going to be the meat in the sandwich.
How scared are you of the Wall Street Journal?
I'm not really somebody who's particularly scared about competition. We really like competition at the Financial Times. We've done very well. We're doing exceptionally well in America right now. We're taking advantage of the fact that if the journal is moving into general news ground, then that offers us a certain opportunity as the specialist business publication with a global presence. It offers an opportunity for differentiation.
What about your future at the Financial Times? I'm sure you'll go on for years to come, but what about your successor? Do you imagine they'll come from a print background, or could the next editor of the Financial Times be a digital native?
The selection of the next editor, when that happens, will not be in my hands. If I had to hazard a guess, I would say that all editors need to have a digital background. Now, you can't just talk about print journalism. And in fact, at least for the last 18 months, I've referred to the FT with absolutely seriousness as a news organization, not a newspaper.
Lionel Barber, the editor of the Financial Times, will hear what he has to say about the News of the World phone hacking saga later on, and thanks to some of you who follow me on Twitter for some of those questions. Mackie Brown, this is the key debate now, isn't it, in newspaper journalism. It's what everybody's talking about, how to make it pay, and should we start introducing charging?
Indeed, and it's easiest for the financial papers or the very specialist papers because they have this specialist information which they sit on and which they can charge for. If you use the FT site, you'll know that there's you can go into it and see some things for free, and then to go deeper you have to pay. I actually subscribe to the paper as well, although it's very expensive, and it is a very limited paper. I mean, it's a narrow cast paper. It's not really in the classic broadsheet tradition at all, and it's becoming more so. Now, as for papers like ours, what strikes me about it is that we ought to really unpack the different elements in the paper. So we have the paper that people buy. We may, I'm sure, continue to do free online services, we may need to unpack things, but there are certainly strong strands in The Guardian that I could imagine charging for, and I include in that the media Guardian websites.
And
perhaps this podcast.
don't know about that. Who would listen?
Who would pay?
this is all very worrying. But we know that the editor of The Times is up for charging. We know that News International more generally is looking at this extremely seriously, and we think they'll be coming forward with proposals very soon and higher up the organisation. Even Rupert Murdoch has said that across the group, charging is on the radar. We know the big American groups are looking at it too. But on the one hand, there's all those people. And then on the other hand, there's a whole load of other people, the digital evangelists, who say that you absolutely can't charge for general news online because no one will pay, because there will always be somewhere else to get it for free. Steve, can you ever imagine paying for any of the services that you currently get, news services that you currently get for free online? Can you imagine starting to pay?
I think we've already said the exact argument, which is niche. You can absolutely see that there can be possibilities there. But when it's broad, it's difficult really to understand that classic web line, how you compete with free. And I think especially in the UK, where you've got the BBC as well and such a strong news presence there online, it's very difficult, I think, to really envisage a scenario where consumers are going to pay for broad news content. I can see it in a niche environment, and I think the FT are coming from a particular place where they almost have an environment to themselves.
Yeah,
don't you think also though that there's possibilities in, as I said, unpacking things, we don't necessarily have to do exactly what we're doing now. It may well be, for example, that there needs to be a great deal more investment in journalism, which is in more depth, so that you put the story up on for free, but to get the further details, an investigative story, for example, red hot investigative story, you will have have to subscribe. There are many ways of baiting this hook, and we haven't really been, how can I put it, commercially attuned to this.
Is there a way, perhaps, Maggie, of doing what you're saying and extending it out a bit and building on the communities that we have? We did our live edition of Media Talk a couple of weeks ago in front of a studio, a live audience. 100 people came. Foolishly, we didn't ask them to pay. But perhaps, you know, you build up your Media Guardian community. You offer events. You offer packages. You offer. It's not just about the journalism.
Exactly.
It's about the networking opportunities.
We have to be entrepreneurial. I'll say another thing about the Times. I'm a subscriber because I live within the M25 to the service where you have papers delivered to your home, and you can see another alternative of raising money, which isn't actually anything to do with online, but it's delivered to your home, and through it they offer you other titles, and increasingly they offer you other things like plants, I mean gardening, you name it, and it's an amazingly good service. Now, for example, this morning my Times Literary Supplement.
You've been planting seeds from the supplied by the Times.
Little plants.
Right.
But
are they any good?
Yes, they're fine. The point is, this morning I was meant to get my Times Literary Supplement in this way, and it lands on my mat, and they have
don't tell me you got a whole load of pansy seeds instead. No?
No.
They've mixed up your subscription.
Listen, I got a letter, first of all, saying they couldn't get it out.
All right.
I then got a phone call. And what James Murdoch is actually doing at the Times is almost like a B Sky B, a subscription service with this incredibly good customer handling side. I'm just pointing this up as another way to go in building revenues for newspapers.
I think it strikes me that a real challenge for the newspapers is readership is in decline amongst younger audiences, and once you start moving onto the net, you're competing as a brand against obviously a number of other brands, and amongst older audiences your brand is already established. You know, as someone who's grown up with newspapers, I know what the Guardian stands for, I know what the Times stand for, and I know what the Sun stands for. With younger audiences, there's a bigger challenge where if they're not buying the newspaper from the newsstand, you've got to somehow entice them on the web in an environment where you're competing with many, many, many brands. And why should I go to the Sun for my entertainment news when actually there may be websites that do it in a far stronger way?
I would have thought that all the newspapers now are more or less aligned. They're in principle always competing, but if there has to be a swift micropayment system introduced in perhaps UK, you can see the advantage in doing it together.
Well, newspapers have signed, I don't know if you know, but in the last couple of weeks they've signed this very portentous thing called the Hamburg Declaration, in which they've basically said that you know, it's all over, you can't just nick our content for free, Google. I mean, they didn't say it in so many words, but there does seem to be, and we've seen the same thing happening in America, that newspaper groups that traditionally competed against each other are now starting to work together.
Well, it's you know, we can only hope that they continue in this way. We all know how disparate and how diverse the press is, and how they can find it very hard to cooperate over a long period of time. But well, this is actually self-preservation now. One of the other big problems is culture, of course. We have all grown up in a system which has assumed that we give our content away for free. The very same people who've led that charge are going to have to do a big U-turn, and that's terribly, terribly hard.
You can find a link to the Hamburg Declaration, I kid you not, and indeed Google's response to it, which is also very interesting. We've put all that up on the Media Talk page, which is guardian.co.uk/MediaTalk. Now, as it's become customary to say, it's been another difficult week for the BBC. The new Culture Secretary, Ben Bradshaw, took the win from the sales of the BBC annual report by denouncing the corporation's big cheeses, calling on them to show some leadership. In the report, the BBC was criticised for lack of ambition and drama, and then news emerged of an enormously long and rather vitriolic email by the veteran drama producer Tony Garnett, who criticised the totalitarian micromanagement of the BBC drama department. We'll come on to the politics in a moment. First, Maggie, what about the row about BBC drama? Does Tony Garnett have a point?
Well, he does have a point in that he represents what you would call authored dramas, in which they start, they begin and they end with the vision of a writer and then a director and producer, and you end up with a very distinctive, almost play for today. I mean, for example, he did Kathy Come Home. That was his big calling card. He's had a fantastic, stellar career, but of course he's at the end of it now. He's got a real position in the industry. So, yes, we
and
do
he says that he says that that creative process that he was used to, that's been squeezed out because of the way things are managed at BBC Drama now with, well, first of all, it was Jane Tranter. We've been around this block before, of course.
Many times,
yeah,
yes.
And now Ben Stevenson, yes. He's the only person who makes the decision. And there's a sort of pyramid that leads up to him, and it's very difficult to get anything through that.
Well, there are many, many critics of Ben Stevenson, and they are people, by and large, who think that their brilliant ideas have been turned down one way or another by the BBC.
But there are plenty of people who says that he's brilliant. I mean, you know,
exactly.
Tony Jordan from EastEnders, Billy Ivory from Commoners, Mark Stephen Moffat from Doctor Who and Sherlock Holmes, Heidi Thomas from Cranford and Peter Moffat from Criminal Justice have all put their names to an article on Media yes. Guardian in defence of Ben Stevenson.
Yes, and this is the debate. As I said, I look back on my viewing over the past month or so. I thoroughly enjoyed Torchwood, which was a great family entertainment.
How brilliant was Torchwood?
I thought
did
it was
you
fantastic.
Watch, did you watch it, Steve?
I mean,
I'd be lying if I said I did. No. So I...
Well, it was brilliant. Yeah. And I also watched Occupation, which is a difficult subject.
How are they going to bring back Torchwood? They've killed them all off.
I know. It's just worrying me. But then John Barrowman did get up into the gods, yeah. didn't he? So hopefully he can come down again at some point when we really need him. But what I'm trying to say is that if you look across the networks at the moment, apart from maybe The Take on Sky, there hasn't been a lot of original drama to actually enjoy. So the BBC's position is even more important and serious because it's attempting, and we had The Street again this week, it's attempting to keep up the amount of drama even in the kind of difficult summer months when traditionally there's no advertising for the rival channels. So it is actually doing a lot of good work, but you can't get around the fact that every now and then something wonderful comes up, like The Devil's Whore on Channel 4, which is an authored piece by Peter Flannery, which was actually originated at the BBC, which actually they don't go through with. So they obviously are making mistakes too in authored drama.
Mm. Well, the Culture Secretary, Ben Bradshaw, weighed in, didn't he? And he, taking the wind out of the sails of the BBC annual report with an extraordinarily worded attack on BBC management. Very surprising for a politician to take such a stance, Steve.
It is surprising, unless you want to take a cynical viewpoint, which says, if I knew that I was going to be looking for a new job in a year's time, I'd make sure my profile was quite high so that I had another job to walk into.
That's and very cynical.
It is cynical, but it can't be, or it must be an element that every politician or every member of the Labour government is thinking at the moment, where am I going to be in a year's time and what am I going to be doing and what consultancies can I hopefully pick up or where can I go with my career?
Where Bradshaw's wrong, though, is he's actually prejudging the outcome of what is a very serious consultation, because if we do actually go down the top slicing route, you are changing the rules of the game for the BBC. It's enjoyed 100% of the licence fee for the past 50 years. To actually change it now is really, and permanently, is really a big decision. So to have the government minister staking his colours to one side of the argument before the argument's been put before the public is actually wrong. It's bad politics.
I think that's absolutely right. And also, isn't it just too easy a target to be having a go at BBC management? I mean, am I the only one who's bored of this? I mean, come on.
Stand up for BBC management then, Steve.
Well, it's not my job to stand up here. But, you know, come on. I mean, there's a lot more serious issues in broadcasting to be talking about at the moment.
Including the forthcoming merger between BBC Worldwide and Channel 4, the joint venture, Maggie, which you think will be signed quite soon?
Well, I mean, I'd be a rash woman, wouldn't I, to say that, because it's been on and off the boil for the past year, really. What's actually happened is that, first of all, Channel 4 wanted just assets out of Worldwide, and it got knocked back on that. That was last autumn. In November, it began negotiating over taking some sort of joint venture with UK TV, the 10 channels that the BBC owns with Virgin Media. That obviously has not been going very well.
It's gone off the boil.
It's gone off the boil. I'm told it's because Andy Duncan keeps trying to add in extra elements when it's actually quite a narrow deal. But the difference now is that the BBC says it's taken out a lot of contentious things, and I don't know what they are, that Channel 4 doesn't like. Channel 4 has applied a more commercial approach to it and pragmatic approach. There is a big problem here because Virgin Media actually own this 50% that Channel 4 would like to have. Virgin Media is quoted on the New York Stock Exchange, so it has to get a proper price. The BBC may therefore buy that stake off Virgin. Channel 4 will then maybe buy a minority stake, depending on what the price is.
Oh, my head hurts. And I'm glad we've got you here, Maggie, to sort all this out.
It still doesn't then actually solve its gap, because I understand that UK TV, as an entity, makes about £50 million of profits a year. So even if Channel 4 ends up with half of it, it makes £25 million, and we're told it's got £100 million.
It doesn't plug the gap.
Mm. And stay with me for one other point.
Go on then.
Right, we all know E4, Morpho, Film 4 are what Channel 4 would put into that deal, because it's got three digital channels. Those, of course, are free to air. Mm. Well, eight of the UK TV channels, which obviously recycle BBC content largely.
Their subscription,
yes. So, interesting question.
Yeah.
Also, just think about the egos involved. Who is the editorial boss of UK TV channels? Jane Bennett.
Oh, God.
Right. Who is the editorial boss of E4?
Kevin Ligo.
Yes.
Mm, yes, that'll be interesting. Okay, thank you very much for putting us straight on that. Whatever your views on any of those BBC issues, post your comments on the blog, guardian.co.uk/mediatalk, where you can also find our recent live show that I was telling you about earlier and the latest edition of Media Talk USA.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on guardian.co.uk.
And we'll stay with the BBC as we enter our section of news in briefs. Steve, Chris Moyles criticised the culture of compliance at the BBC, at BBC Radio, saying that in the post-Ross Brand affair, it's made everything really dull. He said, quote, "The BBC is in a weird state where they don't want to upset anybody. Everything needs to be signed, sealed and approved 18 times. You'll know about this.
I don't know about 18 times, but there is a cautiousness. But on the back of what happened, I just can't be bothered to talk about Russell Brand again. But yeah. on the back of that atmosphere, you can see how that's come about. However, clearly for UK radio to prosper, the BBC has to be in a scenario where it can take risks. Mm. And somehow you've got to find the balance between those two.
Okay. Talking about taking risks, there's been a reshuffle at Radio 1. Fern Cotton, well, Joe Wiley's been bumped off off the morning show to weekday afternoons, replaced by Fern Cotton.
Weekend afternoons,
sorry, yes, to be replaced by Fern Cotton. And they are revamping the afternoons as well. But they're not... They haven't bumped Chris Moyles off of Breakfast, which is what the Sun said they were going to do. I mean, you're a radio and a music man, Steve. What do you make of all the reshuffles?
I've got to share a potential point of conflict, which is we represent Dave Vitti as well, otherwise known as Comedy Dave.
Oh, right.
So
where does he fit into all this?
Well, he's Chris Moyles' sidekick, you see. Okay, so he's part of that team. Between you and the Sun, you'd both like to see Moyles off, but the fact is that he is a good broadcaster. He is reaching a very large section of the audience for the BBC, and he's actually producing some very good radio. And so it's absolutely right that he should still be doing that show.
I'm merely the impartial presenter of Media Talk. I don't express opinions, Steve.
well, that I can't believe. But anyway, in terms of the other presenter changes they've made, absolutely the right moves. I think particularly with Fern Cotton, they're bringing in someone who really connects with the audience in a really strong way.
It was very interesting that in the press release that the BBC put out, the first quote from a BBC executive was not from Andy Parfitt, the controller, but was from Ben Cooper, the deputy controller. He's the man behind all of this, isn't he?
The power behind the throne.
Yeah. Yeah, but he is, though, isn't he? I mean, he's taking the... he said at the Radio Reborn conference organised by The Guardian, he was talking about how he constantly goes through the schedule in his head all the time.
I don't think there's a great secret about that. Andy's got a much larger role now. He's involved in a number of areas of the BBC. Ben's there to deal with the detail, and this is the detail.
Okay. It's quite significant detail, has to be said. This is not
Isn't he supposed to be sorting out the Asian network as well, which is not going very well, Andy Parker?
Is that right?
He is. Yeah.
I was going to say finally, Twitter are most. I know we go on about Twitter all the time, and we get slated for it. For the people who are not on Twitter, they hate the idea of it. But the most read story of the week on Guardian.co.uk was about the revelation by this 15-year-old at Morgan Stanley, who wrote a paper saying that teenagers don't use Twitter. It's a bit of a wake up call to media executives, I suppose, Steve, isn't it?
Actually, I think it's the other way around in terms of why is everyone surprised at this.
Right.
Well, I've got a son who's just 16, and I knew this forever. The other thing is, I think, worryingly for Steve and perhaps for us, they don't listen to radio at all. And that's really bad for the industry. And it's a sign of perhaps losing connection with the younger people. people.
Well, talking about teenagers, we happen to have a real teenager in the office this week when the story was breaking, Eloise Velcevic, and here she is talking to the presenter of our business podcast, Aditya Chakraborty.
I think the underlying problem with Twitter is for celebrities that go on it, it's a big I am, and for the older generation, it's a big I'm young. And as a young person, we don't want to hear about either of that. We want to know what our friends are up to, and if we want to look at news or if we want to look at current affairs, then we'll go on the internet or we'll look in the paper. And Twitter just seems a bit unnecessary and just uninviting for people of my generation. As a 17-year-old, it's not something I'd go on, because most of the people that are on there are in the 30-somethings, and it's all the...
And they're ancient.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Okay, so you're 17 now. At some point, we're hoping that you'll be media consumers in the future and you actually will pay for something. What kind of things would you pay for? What can we get? What can we do to get you to pay for something?
I'd say I might pay for a subscription when I'm older. If there's something I'm, you know, particularly interested in and it gives me specialised information on a subject that I have to know, for example, just say when I'm older I do a degree in history or something and it gives me particular information that will help me with my degree, I might pay for something like that. If it's online and available, because that might be cheaper and easier than getting a book from the library or from getting it via email or other sources.
Give that woman a job, I say. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? In that what she was saying, Steve. I mean, it sounds rather perceptive in a way that we're all getting excited. We all get excited about Twitter because it makes us feel young. Whereas the real young people are not remotely interested.
I think the key point she made was that connection with friends, and that's where you've seen the rise of, you know, some of the key social networking sites, and that's where Twitter slightly falls down.
Because this report or this note that the Morgan Stanley teenager wrote, it's actually quite complex. It doesn't mean that, it's not saying that teenagers are not on social networking sites. They are. They're on Facebook, but they're not on MySpace. They're not on Twitter, but they are on iTunes. You know, it's interesting. It's a more complicated picture than we might seem, Maggie.
Yes. Actually, one of the things that my 16-year-old said to me, well, he said, I would be saving you money if you let me have one of those computer, one of the video boxes, so then I could phone up my friends on that and I wouldn't be charging you money. So I thought, well, that's very interesting.
It wasn't a campaign to oust anybody. It wasn't a campaign to reopen a police inquiry or for more prosecutions or to force anybody to resign. We have not called for any of those. And I'd like to emphasise that as a paper, we do believe in effective self-regulation and we don't want a privacy law. We stated that. When you come to effective self-regulation, it seems to me effective self-regulation can only work if newspaper groups are truthful and open with the regulator. I can think of one or two groups, for example, Associated, who have conceded past patterns of behaviour and put a stop to them. The question is whether News International have been similarly frank. So for me, the three key questions are whether self-regulation was effective in this case, whether the PCC had the full and accurate picture at the time they decided against rigorously investigating the Goodman Mulcair case themselves, and whether, given the reassurances at the time and as further facts came out, they and perhaps you should have been kept informed of those new facts.
That's The Guardian's editor-in-chief, Alan Rusbridger, giving his testimony to the Commons Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee as Murdoch Gate rumbles on. Now, as you know, The Guardian's investigative reporter Nick Davis revealed last week that the News of the World had paid out £1 million to settle civil cases relating to phone hacking. At the same hearing, Davis produced evidence contradicting News International's line that only Clive Goodman, the Red Top's disgraced royal reporter, had used such illegal methods. Maggie, what's been your reaction to the story and how it's played out?
Well, I've been absolutely riveted by it, and it stands to reason, doesn't it, that this was a pretty rampant practice.
It's denied by News International that it is.
Yes, I understand that, but I mean, if that's the case, then £1 million is an awful lot to spend on just one or two cases. The other thing is that I actually think that there have been a number of people leaving, and it would appear to be an attempt maybe to say that we've cleaned up and, you know, that we're no longer doing what we used to do. So I think it's been a tremendously a compelling story. I've been actually quite horrified, really. If Nick is even only half right, at how widespread it appears that this has been.
We'd hope he's a bit more than half right, as we said, otherwise we're all in trouble.
Well, in terms of the numbers,
Absolutely. Steve Ackerman, you have a talent management business as well. This must be something that's of concern to your clients, I guess.
Of course, of course. And actually, we've got clients who have been...
targeted in this way.
Who have been targeted in this way and have been harassed by tabloids, and we've had clients who've had particular issues. I think the story is interesting as well, though. I mean, obviously, as a non-newspaper person, I'm fascinated. It's a fascinating story, but I think it's quite interesting also for kind of what's not being said in terms of, first of all, the way some of the other newspapers are or aren't reporting the story, you know, buried away on page 15 in the Times, and the Independent being a little bit cautious about how it goes about it. And clearly everybody's got a few things in the cupboard that they don't want to come out. And for me, the other thing is, as a football fan, so the three people they've paid off are Gordon Taylor and two footballers. I'd love to know the story.
Yes, there's
obviously a great story
there's a great story there somewhere. It's very interesting what you're seeing about the other newspapers and how they're reporting it. The committee room in the House of Commons where Nick Davis and Alan Rossiter were giving evidence was packed to the rafters full of journalists. Then you look for the coverage the next day. Never have there been so many journalists gathered in one room to write so few words, Maggie.
Yes, that was pretty incredible. I mean, thank goodness for The Guardian, because at least we gave the full account.
Absolutely. Well, I did ask, of course, it would have been a dereliction of journalistic duty not to have asked Lionel Barber what he thought about the whole practice, and this is what he had to say.
We're not sure how widespread it is. There have been new revelations. I mean, a lot did come out 4 years ago. It's deeply troubling and wrong. More broadly, I would say that there needs to be a better balance in Britain between the protection of privacy and the libel law. And I would argue that the libel law currently is actually inimical to investigative journalism. It's too much weighted towards the plaintiff.
So you'd call on the government to look at that?
I'd certainly, and I say that it needs reviewing. We need to review the balance between privacy and libel.
And what about the effectiveness of self-regulation? Does that need looked at as well?
I'm a believer in self-regulation. I'm not saying it's perfect. Journalism isn't perfect. But the idea of statutory regulation is truly frightening, and I hope never comes to pass in Britain. And we need to sort it. If there are practices which are wrong in British journalism, then the editors need to get a grip and take control of their reporters and their news organisations.
Lionel Barber, there was a fantastic blog by Brendan O'Neill on the First Post website. He said that The Guardian is now a greater threat to the society than the News of the World. This is what he wrote. We all need protecting from The Guardian. That oh-so-worthy broadsheet's campaign against the News of the World poses a potentially far greater threat to liberty and press freedom than anything the tacky Sunday tabloid might have done. If journalists did not sometimes break the law, then the truth would remain hidden. There we are. There'll be more from Fleet Street on next week's podcast, when we hope to have a resolution in Richard Desmond's libel case, which has been unfurling rather nicely in the High Court. Read all about it at mediaguardian.co.uk. Before we go, it's time for our final feature, What Did We Learn This Week? Maggie, what did you learn this week?
Well, I, for my sins, was reading the proof of Gene Seaton and James Curran's updated book, Power Without Responsibility, about the British media. And I had completely forgotten this fact, but only 43% of our television content is originated here, less than the 50% that we're supposed to be making. She just pointed this out in the book, and I had simply forgotten how... We don't actually implement the European directive on content. It's where practicable.
That's such a Maggie thing to learn, isn't it?
Well, yeah. It suddenly puts into context why Sky Arts is trying so hard.
Steve, what new fact have you learned this week?
I've definitely learned that Ben Bradshaw is very keen to find a new job within a year, I think.
Well, I learned that that Lionel Barber prefers beer. He bounded up to his drinks reception before the speech this week, and there was canapes and orange juice and red and white wine all laid out, and he asked for beer. Isn't that interesting?
It's not
the sort of thing that...
And he went to Dulwich College. I happen to know. Well, yes, and his son goes to Dulwich College.
Well, there we
and his
are.
Son
you're
is in Harry Potter.
Oh, well, listen, if we're getting gossipy, then the other thing I learned is Richard Bacon goes to a yoga on a Tuesday in Hampstead.
No, that's a fantastic fact. Why?
Because I bumped into him in Hampstead.
Well, you were getting to yoga too.
I wasn't. I was actually having a meeting there, and funnily enough, Richard Bacon passed by 2 minutes after I'd seen imagine Liam Gallagher walking down the street with his missus. Well, so there we go.
It's all good.
You live in the wrong part of London.
It's all good in Hampstead. This is what producer Ben has learned. It's that Five Live business correspondent Andy Verity does a fine line in inadvertent innuendo. Here he is reporting from a greasy spoon in Northampton. Cover your ears, Maggie.
Yes, we are, Sheila. And my super sausage has disappeared down my cake hole, as I said earlier.
The perils of live. I'm really glad that Media Talk isn't live. You know, I don't know how we've managed.
You need Gareth back, don't you, if you're playing Gareth those back. Sorts of clips.
On that note, it's time to wave goodbye. Thank you to Steve Ackerman and Maggie Brown. You can post your comments and find links to all our stories that we've discussed this week on the blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. And at the risk of ridicule, we're also on Facebook and Twitter. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green, who's getting married. Apparently I thought you were already married, Ben. Apparently he's getting married again.
He's Jewish. Week. You're allowed to marry lots of people. Well, it's an unknown Jewish law.
Yes, it's the same person that he's marrying. I think the rabbi's involved this weekend. anyway, it's already being not called the Showbiz Event of the Year. Congratulations to Ben, Emma, and all the Greens, and fingers crossed for the weather. I'm Matt Wells. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.